Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin in Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, and Ken, I have to ask you this morning, what's Greta Van Susteren really like?
Well, actually, I was on the show right after the debate via phone.
So you didn't actually get to meet Greta?
But most of my relationships with women is on the phone.
Well, so I can imagine that. I can see how that would be true. But it was very interesting to hear your voice narrating the debate while John McCain was pacing around silently on the screen. And you seemed to reach a kind of almost lip sync there with John McCain while he was speaking silently and you were explaining the debate to Greta.
Well, I was explaining what John McCain has to do, whether he did it or not, and the question is whether he did what he needed to do, and could he, given the fact that so many people have already made up their minds, given the fact that if Barack Obama does have a 6-7 point lead, as most polls show, have debates in the history of debates, have they ever been a turning point for candidate trailing? And the answer is no.
Well, let's also give McCain credit for doing the best he could in a real trap last night. He was trying to do two things at once, and one would have to say they were somewhat contradictory. He was trying to reestablish the John McCain we all knew at one time as Mr. Straight Talk and the likable maverick, if you will, and at the same time go after Barack Obama on some of his vulnerabilities and bring him down, bring him to earth a little bit, as his campaign's been trying to do in recent days. Those are two tough things to do simultaneously, and he seemed to be getting in his way a lot as a result.
Well, also the fact is that he's lost control of the conversation. I mean, if the conversation were about experience versus lack of same, then, you know, John McCain had an ace up his sleeve. But when the conversation is a constant falling in the Dow, constant falling of 401ks, it's now 201ks, right? Is it now?
If that.
Yeah, lower than that.
Right.
And so with the conversation going on people's financial future, it's the in-party that suffers, and that's the Republican Party of George W. Bush, and McCain took the hits.
He tried very hard, though, to make clear again and again that this was not, well, it wasn't, you know, your father's Oldsmobile. It wasn't your father's Republican Party. He was not George W. Bush. And he went particularly to this point when he wanted to talk about his own plan for getting us out of the mortgage mess, the credit crunch, the financial meltdown that we're in. Here's a little bit of the formula that John McCain put out for the first time last night.
You know that home values of retirees continues to decline, and people are no longer able to afford their mortgage payments. As President of the United States, Alan, I would order the Secretary of the Treasury to immediately buy up the bad home loan mortgages in America and renegotiate at the new value of those homes, at the diminished value of those homes, and let people be able to make those payments and stay in their homes.
So John McCain now proposing that in some sense or another, the federal government become the guarantor of all sour mortgages in the country, essentially take over the mortgages of the homes that are going to otherwise be in danger of foreclosure. Is that a Republican idea, Ken?
Well, it's not. And I guess Sam, as in Uncle Sam, is the child of Freddie and Fannie. I knew they finally had a child and they were expecting. But it's not something, first of all, so many Republicans in the House and Senate voted for a government bailout slash rescue plan that put government intervention in the so-called in the free market system, which is not a Republican position. And here we have John McCain suggesting that the government buy up these overpriced mortgages to help, you know, people who are threatened with foreclosure. But again, this is something that he needed to shake up the race, shake up the dynamic. This was, I think, the only headline to come out of the debate, although it's interesting, as dramatic as a move as it was, he didn't keep referring to it. I thought if this was going to be his signature moment of the second debate of three debates, he would talk about it more. He offered it. It was interesting, and he never went back to it.
I thought that was remarkable, and also that almost all the information that we did receive about the plan, including its name, came from not the debate and not from John McCain personally, but from emails that were coming from his campaign during the debate. That was the main way in which the details, the structure of this was laid out. That's a little bit on the meta side, it seems like to me. You had to have been on the email list for the McCain campaign. You had to be even a member of the media or somehow connected to the campaign to find out what it was really all about.
The meta side?
Yes, M-E-T-A. It's a Greek prefix, actually, meaning beyond. It goes a little beyond what the media have in the past.
As in, I never met a bailout I didn't like?
That could be another way to use the same phrase.
That's how we talk here in Columbus, Ron. You know, something that also struck me about the debate, and again, you try to see what needs to be done and what's going to, and you know that John McCain, there's a certain contempt that he has for being on stage with somebody who's been in the Senate for 15 minutes.
Well,
we're talking about this energy plan that Bush and Cheney supported. Of course, John McCain, didn't support it. And he says, you know who voted for it?
That one.
I winced. I did wince.
It was the finger jab. I'm not going to look at him, but that one.
Yeah, I don't think it was race. A lot of people, I think, you know, in the studio audience we had here in Columbus, a lot of people talked about possibly race. I did hearken back to 1992 when addressing the NAACP, Ross Perot talked about you people. And I winced it. I remember wincing at that too. I didn't think of it as race, but there was a contemptuous feeling coming out of John McCain.
Well, here's the question. Can you be contemptuous on stage with one other person who happens to be black and not have it have a racial tinge? Well, can you be contemptuous of somebody for reasons entirely other than race, but be on stage in front of a national television audience and show contempt towards that person and not have it be tinged in some sense by race?
Well, I don't think it was race. I think it was the fact that John McCain, having all this experience, having all these decades in Congress, somebody who's been in the Senate for 15 minutes, and here I am losing to this guy, as John Lovitz said in the 1988 debate.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
Exactly. So I think the same kind of exasperation was on John McCain. I don't think it was race, but I could see people wondering what exactly was in his mind. But, you know, there was also the ads that McCain have come out with tying Obama to Bill Ayers, and he hangs around with terrorists. Now, do I think that was racial? No, I don't think that was racial either.
Well, not Bill Ayers, perhaps.
No, that's
not racial.
But when they said,
but what's going to come next? What's the next set of ads going to be after the Bill Ayers ads have played out and they've tried to convince people that Barack Obama is sympathizing with domestic terrorists?
Well, it could be the Reverend Orville and Wilbur Wright.
Yes. Jeremiah Wright will doubtless be making a return appearance here in the next several weeks before this campaign is over. There's videotape of the Reverend saying, "God bless America, no! God damn America!" And we've all seen that videotape, but we're going to see it again, and we're going to see that one played out. And I think that's why the discussion of whether or not there was an intentional racial dimension to some of that contempt last night is precursor to that discussion.
You know, Ron, we don't talk like that in Columbus.
No, I don't think you would talk that way in Columbus. But
no.
One thing I noticed about McCain last night was he was telling us who his heroes were. Three of his heroes were Ronald Reagan. Three times he told us that Ronald Reagan was his hero. Then we heard that his hero was Teddy Roosevelt.
That's right.
And the quotation that he wanted to use from Teddy Roosevelt was the one, perhaps his most famous, "Speak softly, but carry a big stick," in terms of international relationships.
And that was a reference to the fact that when the question was whether the U.S. should take a preemptive attacks into Pakistan if the government was unable or unwilling to go after al-Qaeda and the Taliban and Osama bin Laden. Barack Obama in the past has said that he would do so if the government was unable and unwilling, and that was not, you know, good for John McCain. He said, look, whatever we want to do, you don't want to telegraph your move, you don't want to announce to the world what we plan to do. You want to, as McCain said, speak softly and carry the big stick.
To which Obama replied,
"Senator McCain, this is the guy who sang Bomb, Bomb, Bomb Iran, who called for the annihilation of North Korea. That I don't think is an example of speaking softly. This is the person who, after we hadn't even finished Afghanistan, where he said, next up, Baghdad."
Ultimately, I think both McCain and Obama are on the same page of what to do in Pakistan. But I think that McCain's argument about speaking softly and carrying a big stick was easily dismissed by Barack Obama. I thought that Barack Obama did the same thing when John McCain talked about Obama's ties to Franny and Freddie. And then, of course, Barack Obama had the response of saying, well, look, your campaign manager, although this was interesting, Barack Obama said your campaign manager was a lobbyist for Fanny, when, of course, he meant Freddie.
But, you know, I can never tell Fanny and Freddie apart. Can you?
You know, actually, the way the guys wear the long hair today, I'm having the same problem here, especially here in Columbus.
All right, Ken, you've already said that you don't think the debate was going to change the national polling numbers. Nothing seems to have changed the national polling numbers so much as just the souring of the economy. When the economy went south, when we had the financial meltdown, there seemed to be a big tectonic plate shifting in the direction of the Democrats.
just enough to overcome what had become a slight lead for McCain and put Obama ahead just outside the margin of error in the national polls. But what's really, really been attracting the attention of both campaigns and the media in the last week or so is a more dramatic shift in the battleground states.
And look at the states that everybody is either too close to call or the ones they're really fighting over. If it's Ohio, if it's, by the way, did I tell you I was in Columbus? Yeah. If it's Ohio, it's Florida, it's North Carolina, it's Virginia, what do they all have in common?
They all voted for George Bush twice.
Exactly. And it seems like all the blue states, all the states that John Kerry, Al Gore won in 2000, at least John Kerry in 2004, Barack Obama seems to be doing pretty well there. The big news, of course, last week was that John McCain has pulled out of Michigan. He removed all his troops from there, and I think he sent them into Georgia. And South Ossetia.
Well, there are three states that switched between 2000 and 2004, back and forth between red and blue.
Mexico, Iowa, and New Hampshire.
All of which now seem to be landing in Barack Obama's column by varying degrees. Iowa
right.
looks pretty safe for him now. New Hampshire right. seems to be moving that direction. New Mexico
And that was
as
a
well.
Toss-up for the longest time.
For the longest time, and now it appears to be moving in Obama's direction. And then there are some other states that were not really considered battlegrounds 6 months ago that have become competitive. And I'm not just talking about Virginia. That's been out there for a while. Colorado's been out there for a while. But we're now talking about North Carolina, and we're talking about Indiana. And while it's hard for me to believe, Missouri is also being tossed into the hopper. I find it hard to imagine any of those three states being competitive for Barack Obama, but that's what the numbers are showing. Why is he doing so much better in these battleground states than he's doing even in the national polls?
Well, you know, even if you have a 5-6 point lead in the national polls, if you have a 5 or 6 point lead in these battleground states and the states as well, you could have a slight lead among the popular vote, but you could have a landslide in the Electoral College. John F. Kennedy only won the presidency by, what,
100,000 votes.
100,000 votes, but he had over 300 electoral votes because that slight lead and the dead people in Chicago helped him get, you know, the election in 1960. And so states like Indiana, which has not gone for a Democrat since Lyndon Johnson in 64, North Carolina, which last voted for a Democrat, Jimmy Carter, in 76. These are states there where were taken for granted by the Republican Party, as they were talking about perhaps inroads in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. Now they're back on the defensive on these states where they never thought they'd have to worry about.
What else can change this election from now on, Ken? We've got a little under 4 weeks to go. We've got one more debate on October 15th. What could change the dynamic?
Well, you always talk about an October surprise. I mean, you know, after Russia invaded Georgia, would they invade New Jersey now? I mean, you know, there's only 50 states.
New Jersey's been asking for it.
Well, they should. I mean, what exit, you know?
Speaking of fighting in the states, some of these Senate races around the country continue to change. And I know this one's kind of close to your heart, Ken. I've just been out in Minnesota in the course of the past week, where they had a debate between incumbent Republican Norm Coleman, his famous Democratic challenger, Al Franken, once of Saturday Night Live, and a third-party candidate, Dean Barkley. And I'd like to play just a little tape here of what Dean Barkley had to say in going after Norm Coleman.
Where I differ from Norm more than anything else, or Senator Coleman, is his decision to get us into that war. I didn't support that war from day one. I got the same top-secret military briefing that other U.S. senators got. I was not convinced when I went out of that briefing. I think that was his first trillion-dollar mistake, and the second was his failure to watch over the financial industry. So that's your second trillion-dollar mistake. My question to you is, how many more trillion-dollar mistakes do we have to put up with?
Okay. You know, it reminds me of basically the 1998 race for governor of Minnesota, when the same Norm Coleman was a Republican nominee. Skip Humphrey, Hubert Humphrey's son, was a Democratic nominee. And a guy named Jesse Ventura was an independent.
You don't mean Jesse Ventura, the wrestler. The guy with the boa.
The body, right.
Yeah, the body,
boa,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he was actually elected governor of Minnesota.
Well, it's because he fought in the Boa Wars.
And 35% was enough for him.
He fought in the Boer Wars.
35% was enough for Jesse Ventura to be elected over Coleman and Humphrey, who canceled each other out. Now, I'm not saying Dean Barkley is going to get elected to the United States Senate, but he is putting a bruise on Norm Coleman, not only in terms of the percentage of the vote that he's taking, but in the sharpness of his attacks on Coleman and the Bush administration. And that's got to help Al Franken have a real shot here.
Exactly. He's doing exactly the Jesse Ventura playbook from 98. First of all, Ventura never liked Coleman. He went after Coleman in 98 and basically won the election. Also, one of the reasons Jesse Ventura won the election was that he was allowed to participate in the debates unlike Ralph Nader, Bob Barr, and which was a song, of course, that John McCain was singing. Exactly. And Cynthia McKinney and all those third-party candidates. So Dean Barkley is not going to be elected, although, you know, he was appointed to the Senate by Governor Ventura for a short time after Paul Wellstone died. But Barkley is going after Norm Coleman. Coleman was hoping this would be a referendum on Al Franken. Al Franken with his incendiary comments that I think offended a lot of people, not only in Minnesota, but here in Columbus, Ohio.
But if it's not going to be about Al Franken,
right,
if it's going to be about Norm Coleman and the Bush administration, that's the worst scenario for Coleman.
Right. Before we leave Minnesota, Ron, I'd like to a hearty call out to your dad, who the reason you were in Minnesota last week was his birthday. I want to wish your dad a very belated, but nonetheless, a very happy birthday.
Yes, we celebrated there in Minnesota my father's 93rd birthday. He lives out in Washington State now, but came back to the old stomping grounds for that occasion. Thank you, Ken. I'm sure the entire Elbing family appreciates that.
It was my pleasure. But also, now, so if we can add Minnesota to the possible turnovers, we also have New Mexico, we have Colorado, we have Virginia, we have New Hampshire, we have possibly Oregon, which is very close with Gordon Smith.
One other to throw in the into the
and Alaska. Don't forget Alaska.
Ted Stevens. We're still waiting to see what happens with Ted Stevens' fraud trial here in Washington, and down in Mississippi. Do you think Roger Wicker is going to be safe against Ronnie Musgrove?
I do. I mean, of course, we do have a large African-American turnout, which I suspect is one of the reasons why Virginia and North Carolina presidential races have turned so close.
But in Mississippi, maybe that triggers a very heavy white turnout as well.
Plus the fact that Haley Barbour, who one, appointed Roger Wicker to the Senate after Trent Lott resigned, and two, defeated the Democratic nominee for the Senate this year, Ronnie Musgrove, and Haley Barbour does not like Ronnie Musgrove. He can't even pronounce his name.
Haley Barbour himself remains quite a popular figure in Mississippi.
Right.
He has not suffered from his own association with George W. Bush. Let's just take a quick pass now past that other chamber that is also in the United States Capitol building, the House of Representatives, always covering itself in glory, always America's favorite political institution. How much more Democratic is it going to get, Ken?
I think it's 15 seats is probably a good number. We haven't gone race by race in a while yet, and we need to update the NPR map, which is on npr.org. And one of the reasons we haven't done it in a while is because of all these amazing changes of what's going on in both the presidential and the Senate race. There are some opportunities for Republican pickups.
Texas?
Exactly.
Louisiana?
Tom DeLay's old seat, a special election in Louisiana, perhaps Mark Foley's old seat in Florida.
Elsewhere in the South?
Exactly, elsewhere in the South.
Georgia?
I don't know about that. Jim Marshall is always threatened, but he always wins re-election. And again, the trend line just seems to be going in the Democratic direction. There will always be surprises. But in 2006, what was so fascinating about that year is that there was not one single seat, either an open seat or an incumbent on the Democratic side that went to the Republicans. And that's the first time that happened in at least a half century.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.
Ron, did I tell you that I was in Columbus?
Can you just tell me a little bit about Greta?